This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. As the Pentagon scrambles against scheduled budget cuts, we speak today with the executive director of the National Priorities Project about the military budget in the person of Joe Comerford. Also today, we'll be joined by Alex Beauchamp of Food and Water Watch about the latest legislation to try and preserve water tables in the United States, as well as a review of the development of the anti-fracking and water preservation movement across the country following recent lobbying and protest events. And coming up right after this, a live interview with the chief software engineer of the NASA Mars Science Laboratory. All of that and more. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow, originating at WBAI, and I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we now have the distinct honor of speaking with the chief software engineer of the NASA Mars Science Laboratory, colloquially known as the Mars Curiosity Lander. We're now speaking live with Ben Cici. Welcome to 5 O'Clock Shadow, sir.
Hi, great to be with you.
Well, no, it is our honor. That was a masterful piece of work, the August 6th landing in the Gale Crater of the surveyor called Curiosity. First of all, let me just ask on the part of yourself and your colleagues, are you still in jubilation or have you started moving to the perspiration of the work that will be done over the next few years with this mission?
Well, that's a great way to put it. You know, I mean, I think that we are. There's still a euphoria around lab, and I can, when we walk around the team, everyone still has big smiles on their face from ear to ear, and there's just still that sense of real excitement that comes over from being able to land a rover on the surface of Mars. But at the same time, the team is really getting in gear and really excited for beginning our expedition. You know, in some ways that this was the end of a very long journey, and then it's also the beginning of a whole nother journey, a journey of expedition, the expedition that the Curiosity rover, and we're all very excited to see what she's going to find and to start get going with the science phase of the mission.
Well, that was one hell of an interplanetary lag put that had to travel at high velocity and then slow down just enough to not crash the vehicle as it landed. And you and the team used a novel approach, did you not, with the arrow breaking of the parachute, the ejection of the heat shields and the superstructure, and then a crane with a cable that was suspended by rockets. Can you please describe what a magnificent feat that was?
Yeah, I mean, this is an unprecedented Mars landing. I mean, to be able to, when we started designing this mission, we realized that in order to do the science that we wanted to do on the surface of Mars, we needed to design a large and capable rover that could carry all of these science instruments down to the surface. And what we quickly realized was to do the science the rover needed to be five times as massive as the past rovers that we've built and landed on Mars. And so the old landing systems that we had used, like the airbag landing systems that we used for Mars exploration rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, they just wouldn't work for the Curiosity rover. So we had to design a whole new landing system. And that landing system had to get us down from the entering the Mars atmosphere at 13,000 miles an hour down to a nice, more comfortable 1.5 miles an hour at touchdown. And in order to do that, first we had to use a large heat shield to slow us down to a couple hundred miles an hour, and then a supersonic parachute that deployed. And while we were on the parachute, that actually slowed us down to a couple hundred miles an hour. And then the most exciting part was the rover and the descent stage drop off the back shell, drop off the parachute, jettison that parachute that's slowing us down to 200, but not slow enough to be able to land on Mars, and then slow down and hover right above the surface, and then start what's called the sky crane maneuver, where the rover actually lowers itself down on a bridle, what is really just a rope, and lowers itself down on that rope to touch down nice and slowly on the surface of Mars. And then once we're there, we still have to cut that rope, and the descent stage has to fly off and land on its own far away from the rover.
That is absolutely magnificent. And during the landing, which I think people around the world were watching or listening to, one of the moments that gave me joy was to hear that the locally orbiting Mars Observer had established communications during the process of the landing. And there is this beautiful moment of standing by between the establishment of contact and then the fulfillment of protocol, the handshaking and the data exchange that would follow. As chief software engineer, sir, Mr. Bin Seiji, tell us what the digital demands were.
Well, the rover essentially has to be smart enough to land itself. And so the software on board the rover is what's controlling the rover from right at the top of the atmosphere until the 7 minutes of terror until we get down onto the surface of Mars. And since there's this speed of light delay between Mars, it takes a signal from Mars 14 minutes to make it back to Earth, there's no way for the Earth to actually control this landing sequence. So the software has to control it all. And so that includes both the landing sequence that we talked about, the sky crane maneuver, but also the communication pathway. And so there, it really becomes a team effort where we use our other missions that NASA has around Mars, specifically the Mars Odyssey Orbiter and the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. And so we had to have our friends on the Mars Odyssey Orbiter project adjust their orbit of the Mars Odyssey Orbiter just so it was flying overhead as Curiosity was landing. And then so Curiosity could beam back the messages from Mars, its signals from Mars saying that it was landing, saying that it landed safely through the Mars Odyssey Orbiter and then relayed back to Earth. And so when we saw that signal, it was just jubilation because we could tell as we were going along that Curiosity was safe. And then once we're on the surface, it was just utter, unbelievable excitement when we got to see those first images as they were beamed back from Odyssey, from Curiosity, through the Mars Odyssey orbiter that was flying overhead into mission control.
In addition to the novelty of the landing method, were there any software and communications techniques or protocols that had to be either invented or enhanced in order to do these things and also to buffer the tremendous amounts of data that will be recorded and gotten by the Curiosity lander and using the windows of communication through one satellite or another and the delay time to Earth? Did you have to invent new cybernetic stuff?
We used building blocks that were there because Mars Odyssey has been at Mars for a long time, right, since 2001. So we had to use the tools that Mars Odyssey had, but we had to stitch them together in a whole new way. So we had to build this whole new EDL communication strategy, and that included figuring out how to make it so that the data that Curiosity was sending had very low delay in making it back to Mars Odyssey and making it to us in the control room, because we don't want to have a lot of delay because we might miss something that's going on the rover. So that was all new in order to tune the software and to tune the communication protocol so that it was the minimum amount of delay from when the rover said it to when Odyssey heard it to when it was beamed back to us in the control room. And so that was a whole new communications protocol that we had to develop between the rover, the orbiter, and all the way back to Earth in the control room.
The entry, descent, and landing procedure now with the warming up and the testing of Curiosity means that you will have various forms of latency in getting the information back, whether it be the uplink to a local satellite around Mars, whether it be to other facilities to relay the information back to Earth and to the terrestrial laboratories. Now, there is another duty cycle that is interesting that had not immediately occurred, which is the day and night cycle of Mars. We are given to understand that it is powered by a plutonium-238 fueled thermocouple that produces not only electricity but heat, and that the active duty cycle of the lander is not going to be a full Martian day, but only the, I guess, the sunlit part. How does that work, and how does the device sustain its energy and ration the expenditure of it?
Yes, our power source is this radioisotope thermoelectric generator that you said, what we call it is the RTG. And so the RTG, while it's generating its energy, it really only gives us 100 watts, about 100 watts of energy 100 watts of power for the rover to be able to operate on. And so the rover, being a really capable science lab on the surface of Mars, actually is a little bit more power hungry than that. It requires a little bit more than 100 watts.
So the SUV-sized lander is also an energy guzzler.
That's right. It is. It is an energy guzzler. So what we need to do is it needs to take naps. And so the rover goes to sleep. And during that period of time, what we do is that the RTG charges the battery up. And so while the rover is asleep, the battery is charging. And so when the rover wakes back up, it not only uses the power from the energy from the RTG, it's also using the energy out of those batteries that we have on board, those two big batteries that we have on board. And it uses that energy to be able to do the science until the batteries are depleted and the rover says, okay, I have to go sleep again. Time to recharge my batteries. Much like you or I have to do every night, recharge our batteries.
Ben Cici is the chief software engineer for the NASA Mars Science Laboratory, known as the Curiosity Lander. And at this point in time, Ben, what is the state of the stretching out and warming up and checkout of the lander for its long-term mission?
Well, it's great. We just completed yesterday. We had Sol 1 on board the rover, and so the rover has now gone through its sleep cycle at the end of the first Sol on Mars, which we called Sol 0. It went to sleep, woke up on Sol 1, completed some initial checkout activities, including this great color image that we saw today from the Mars Hand Lens Imager. And so we had that great image, and then the rover has gone back to sleep and is now beginning its second full Sol on Mars, our Sol 2 activity. And today we have a lot of exciting activities where we'll actually deploy the remote sensing mast, so the big 7-foot-tall mast that has all of our primary science cameras on the top of it. And so we'll be able to actually take today an image of the rover from the top of this mast, which will give us a great view, our first real view of how the rover is looking there in Gale Crater, what the top of the rover looks like, and we'll be able to see how all of our science instruments are doing on the surface of Mars. And so that's a really exciting thing. We'll also get to test out our mast cam for the first time, which is our color imagers on top of the remote sensing mast, and we'll take some more measurements from our radiation detector. And so we have a lot of exciting things planned for the rover to do on Sol 2. And we're still very much in this characterization phase where we're learning more about how the rover is doing on the surface of Mars and really gearing up for this expedition, this science expedition that we have ahead of us.
Well, hopefully the device will be able to climb the Aeolus or the central mountain inside the crater without rolling over and continue to bring, I suppose, a global and interplanetary joy for a great piece of work. Ben Cici, as chief software engineer, final question for you is what will you be busy with over the next days, weeks, months, and years?
Well, first up, we're actually going to be, over the next few days, loading a whole new version of software on board the rover. So we have, you know, our rover was really, we taught it to be very, very smart about landing, and that required a lot of smarts out of the rover. And we kind of saved some software that was going to be able to allow it to do the smarts for the surface mission to give it, to wait until we get on the surface and then uplink that software. So we have this software transition that's going to happen over the next few sols. And then after that, we'll really start to begin our science mission in earnest. And I'll be involved in helping to plan those science activities and to plan where we're going to go with the rover and be able to really, you know, I think we're really excited to allow Curiosity to get out and stretch your legs or stretch your wheels, as it may be. And so I'll be involved in helping to plan those activities.
And as a valedictory, Ben Cici, Chief Software Engineer of the Mars Science Laboratory. With this opportunity to speak to the world, to the national and international audiences of this network, this program, what would you have people think has been accomplished that includes the mutual interests of all?
Well, I mean, I think it's amazing when you step back and you can walk out at night, and anyone on the whole planet can walk out and look up at Mars and say, together we did this. We put this amazing vehicle, this embodiment of what is human curiosity, on the surface of another planet. And it was an effort that wasn't just done by a single group of people. It involved teams that were across the entire world. We have instruments from other countries. All the states in our union were contributing in some way to this endeavor, and we can really say that this is humanity at its best, pulling together and being able to say that, hey, what's important to us is being able to explore. It's what we were made to do in some way. We were born to explore, and this is us all stepping forward together and taking the next step in what is our collective journey.
Well, congratulations and thank you. Ben Cicci, Chief Software Engineer for the NASA Mars Science Laboratory Curiosity Experiment. I know you're busy. Thank you for joining us today on 5 O'Clock Shadow.
Thank you.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacific Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we're now joined live by Joe Comerford of the National Priorities Project on this occasion, in which there's a great amount of scrambling about the closing of bases and the reduction of the acceleration of the increase of the United States military budget. Welcome, Joe. And what is this moment of military financial crisis in America?
Well, thank you so much for having me. You're quite right to say that there is a buzz happening about the military budget and its proposed reduction and the potential impact. And in fact, the budget that President Obama put before the nation did see about a 2.6% decrease in overall military spending from 2012 actual to 2013 projected. So you're quite right about that, and everybody reporting that is quite right. The thing that's been perhaps made to look larger is the notion that the military budget or the Pentagon budget is being gutted. That absolutely isn't the case. We are not seeing a total downward slope of the Pentagon budget. Actually, we will see this 2.6% reduction from this year to next, and then actually it'll plateau and actually go up a little bit over the years adjusted for inflation.
There has been an announcement from Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta that the military base closings that were touted as some form of incremental solution to military spending would not be proceeding as planned. What do you know about that?
Well, you know, there's actually a lot of conjecture right now. We are understanding that, in fact, these base closings aren't going to proceed apace. Some people say that that's actually going to be difficult to achieve if we want to have the cuts that the president has proposed and that many Americans think are important. It's important to keep in mind that at the magnitude of U.S. bases around the world, bases are hard to measure because they range in size of, you know, from an occupied position in a particular geographic area in places outside the U.S., like a cell tower, all the way to very large bases in countries like Germany and Iraq. But, you know, in fact, there are well over 700 U.S. bases across the globe. We're the only nation in the world with this kind of reach. And incremental base closings are often part of the national conversation in times of alignment and or in times of greater fiscal scrutiny, and this is just one of those times.
To paraphrase Bob Dylan's Desolation Row, they might just rearrange their bases and give them all another name.
Right. Right. You're good to paraphrase Dylan. Yeah, you know, I mean, I think there's one of the things that's really hard, I'll speak frankly, is that there is quite a lot of smoke and mirrors when we talk about military spending. And one of the ways in which we're talking about decreases in military spending is in comparing it to the kind of projected growth that we have been experiencing over the last decade. So, for example, from about 2002 to 2012, military expenditures or Pentagon expenditures increased by 48%. This is in terms of inflation-adjusted dollars. That's an enormous jump, 48% over just a decade. You know, and the other part, social spending, by comparison, increased a fraction of that.
Well, Joe, just to stay on this military spending, that's quite a good investment to get a 48% return. Now, is most of this spending on new weapons material construction expenditures, or is the pensioning and medical care and insurance and human cost of the operation of the Pentagon and members of the military, what is the rough proportion between new equipment and human service?
That's a good question. By and large, the largest driver is people. You know, we cost a lot in terms of our salaries and our health care in any organization, and, you know, the military is not exempt from that. So the military struggles to maintain its health care costs and to keep pace with the expansion of that cost over time, much like our nation does, which is, you know, why one of the many reasons that meaningful health care reform is vital. In this nation. And then, you know, as we grow larger, we have a larger and larger footprint, we cost more to maintain, to move around, to ensure all of that costs U.S. tax dollars. Certainly, on top of this is also the sort of the operational cost of the U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which were themselves their own large drivers of cost. And there were absolutely escalating weapons costs that were associated to those U.S. wars in terms of replacement costs and things like that for weapons destroyed in war. But it's not, they're smaller than the personnel costs.
Which brings us back to the comment about the military bases and the moving around of them and the proliferation and the construction of new ones, such as, if I recall correctly, there are still dozens of facilities of the United States, even in Iraq, that is characterized as having been withdrawn from. There are increasing bases and commitments around Pakistan and Afghanistan, and increasing transportation costs to go around the occasionally closed NATO route through Pakistan to Afghanistan. There are growing impulses to have bases in the continent of Africa, and certainly the environs of Incirlik Air Base in Turkey and other facilities in the Mideast. Do you think that they represent a driver to the growth of Pentagon expenditures?
Oh, sure. Yeah, our global footprint is, you know, in military phrasing, they call that force structure. So our force structure absolutely is unparalleled in across the globe, right? We are unbelievably large and far-reaching compared to every other nation in the world. We're at more than 43% of the world's global military spending. And that kind of reach comes with it a lot of cost. It takes a lot to keep us that extended on bases like you're right to mention AFRICOM, right, the most recent command center that was set up. You know, that takes billions and billions of dollars, both to create, you know, to land, to situate, and then to staff over time and to resource. So our extension globally has to do with our force structure and the plan, you know, the U.S. military idea for how big it should be. And then it absolutely is related to the cost of the bottom line Pentagon budget.
Our guest is Joe Comerford of the National Priorities Project. And Joe, another issue that is boiling, particularly roiling Congress, is the legislation that ostensibly would refer to the legislation that ostensibly would require a reduction in military spending or of the overall national budget over the coming months and years. And already there are efforts to reverse even that constraint. Have you been keeping an eye on the attempted retrenchment of the retrenchment?
Sure. Yeah. And you're talking, you're again, wise to bring up sequestration. So sequestration has been in our sights. You'll pardon that that metaphor.
Of course.
Since the Budget Control Act, right, and that was an act of Congress that was basically a strong arming, if you will, of the president, because the president was urging our nation, rightly so, to raise the debt ceiling, which before this very politicized time had been a very pro forma act, meaning that the debt ceiling is about past debt incurred, and there really shouldn't be in reasonable times. Much conversation about whether or not to raise it. Certainly we can talk about costs going forward, but whether or not to keep good on our debt and actually thinking about not keeping good on our debt is nearly an act of political and national economic peril. So the president was saying, we have to raise this. This is summer 2011. We've got to do it. And Congress passed this thing called the Budget Control Act. And the first bit of this was an immediate $917 billion swipe at spending only in the discretionary budget over a decade. And it was basically half gotten from the security environs, and that security in the president's sense, meaning Pentagon budget and the like, and then half gotten from social spending called non-security in this paradigm and gotten from social programs like environment, education. And that went through immediately, and then Congress raised the debt ceiling. And then they put something together called this super committee, and the super committee failed, and so we got sequestration. It was supposed to find $1.2 trillion in cuts. It wasn't able to do that. And then Congress said, okay, so we're going to get these for you, and they're going to go into effect in 2013. Now, no one wants sequestration. It was meant to be a terribly blunt instrument to make sure that Congress was able to do its job, hopefully by holding that awful thing over its head, it was going to threaten it, in a sense, into working across the aisle. And boy, it wasn't successful, and now we have this terrible instrument. And there almost immediately there was an outcry from the defense industry, from lobbyists, from some members of the Pentagon, not all, saying we can't have it; it's going to gut us. So there was a move to exempt military spending from sequestration, and that movement is still afoot. Similarly, to be fair, social spending advocates, members of the housing community, human services community, said you really can't just cut us across the board. We have to have more of a conversation about that to be planful. Of course, this unfortunately is all coming at a political year, so we have this presidential race ahead of us. And Congress is actually frozen. So it's about to pass something called a CR, a continuing resolution, which is basically freezing spending. So there won't be a budget October 1st, so we won't even talk about it. It's going to kick it way past the election into the new year. So it's all a big ball of political spaghetti. And in it is this notion and this emerging conversation that if we allow sequestration to be gotten in the defense budget, it will be the end. And actually, just to be clear, that simply isn't so. The defense budget is so large, and there are numerous analysts from every angle and every political persuasion who over the years have said, well, actually, there's actually very low-hanging fruit. We could actually simply save money by curtailing waste. We could save money by actually bringing in greater efficiencies, by cutting programs that are actually not useful, very low-hanging programs like Cold War weapon systems, things like that, that in fact a bipartisan commission found that there are about $1 trillion in savings before we even talk about what you were talking about, which is force structure, we could get $1 trillion over 10 years. So the notion that the Pentagon's coming to its knees is hyperbole at best.
Joe, there is another process taking place here, which seems counterintuitive given the simplicity of political rhetoric during campaign seasons in regard to taxes and spending. And in a recent Armed Services Committee hearing, two defense manufacturers, or military manufacturers, I believe it was United Technologies and Lockheed, suggested to the assembled Solons that they need to start thinking about increasing taxes in order to maintain the military at the level to which they have become accustomed. And this is certainly a piece of simplistic rhetoric about no tax increases that is repeated every time there is a presidential or a congressional campaign. But do you think that there is any possible change in the rhetoric or the an effort to indeed increase taxes in order to maintain the runaway expenses of the multiple wars the United States is engaged in, which at last time that I heard from certain economists were approaching a level of ultimate cost of on the order of $4 trillion.
Sure, that's the projected cost.
And is there a possibility that literally Congress might bite the bullet? And
you know, that would be a
taxes.
Sense of it. Would be a sort of ironic, really, and very strange bedfellows. And it actually might be a really interesting way to have achieved some tax policy reform. So one of the things that's in sequestration that is, I think, creating the greatest burn for analysts, for economic analysts, is that there's no option to talk about revenue. It's off the table. So we're frozen in this paradigm where the Bush-era tax cuts package stays static. We don't get to talk about tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans, corporate taxes. We don't get to talk about any of that. That's off the table. So we can't increase the pot, if you will. And so the only way to curtail deficit is to cut spending. So there have been these outcries from the industry saying, well, you know, we need this money, and therefore you're going to have to do some tax reform work and put taxes on the table. To be fair, neither party has been so great about taxes. We've been too afraid to touch corporate taxes and not willing, especially in the Democrats and Republicans last year and Republicans continuing into this year, were not willing to talk about the tax breaks for the wealthiest Americans. So this kind of outcry is interesting and may indeed push the tax conversation forward. Right now, as you know, the notion of cutting taxes or increasing taxes on the wealthiest passed in the Senate, it failed in the House. So we're stalled right now on that issue.
Our guest is Joe Comerford of the National Priorities Project. And there's another issue here about the military budget. In terms of global expenditures, I'm given to understand that the United States military budget is six times larger than the next competitive nation, which would be the People's Republic of China. And
yeah.
So I wonder if the United States has enough to dominate or prevail with that kind of ratio. But how does that become an Ebola economics in terms of reducing productivity, which is certainly an imbalance between the United States and China at this time.
Oh, that's really interesting. That's really interesting. You know, one of the things, that actually members of the Joint Chiefs, members of the high-ranking Pentagon officials have said over and again that actually really a major threat to security in our nation are twofold, right? One camp will say that the environment and environmental degradation is an enormous national security threat, and another camp will say that our tanking economy is a national security threat. And a nation like China, in terms of its economic growth, is an example of a nation that is fast outpacing us in its ability to produce and innovate. And we know that China spends about $129.3 billion every year globally And to, you know, by comparison, the U.S. in 11 spent about $690 billion, $691, something like that. So far outpacing China. And the United States has had to fight for every dollar of stimulus funding. And so you're right to point out the disparity in military spending, and you're right to point out the different views of economic stimulus between the U.S. and China and the way in which China is quickly catching up to the U.S. in terms of growth of our economic sector.
We are really honored and informed to have so knowledgeable an expert as you on this subject today, as new directions are breaking in terms of military economics and domestic tranquility. And we've been speaking with Joe Comerford, the executive director of the National Priorities Project. And please tell people how what you do and how people can learn more about it and these subjects.
Sure. And first, I want to say it's a pleasure speaking with you, and thank you so much for having us on. National Priorities Project is a federal budget research organization. Basically, we crack open the U.S. federal budget so that everyone can make sense of it and feel like they have a voice, an effective and strategic voice in shaping a budget that reflects our own, all of our priorities. We can be found online at nationalpriorities.org. We also have a cost of war counter at costofwar.com. We're, of course, on Facebook and Twitter, and we have a YouTube channel where we break this information down into two-minute chunks on YouTube, and we have videos out and things like that. We also have a new book out called A People's Guide to the Federal Budget, which we hope will make this larger concept of the U.S. federal budget more accessible. And we're here for you, so contact us with any kinds of questions.
Well, thank you once again, Joe Comerford of the National Priorities Project at the website nationalpriorities.org. This is 5 o'clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we'll be back with more on the environment. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we continue with the state of the ecology of another world, in this case, Earth. We're now joined by Alex Beauchamp of Food and Water Watch. And Alex, welcome to 5 o'clock Shadow.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we understand that there has been some motion in preserving the water tables across this country in the face of the enhanced fracking initiatives and such. Can you tell us what step has been taken?
Yeah, well, I think you're talking about the Federal Trust Fund for Clean Water Infrastructure, which is sort of a mouthful, but is a an important bill. And this, what this would do is really provide critical funding for our wastewater systems. So these are sewer systems across the country. And this obviously isn't, you know, perhaps the most exciting topic for a lot of politicians, but it's critically important. A lot of these systems are, you know, over 100 years old, and funding has fallen behind to the point where we're now $22 billion a year behind, and the results are pretty dire. So it's exciting that this bill was just introduced by Representative Blumenauer. This is something that, you know, Food and Water Watch has been advocating for over the last 6 years, and obviously we'll look forward to working with Representative Blumenauer to you know, keep the bill strong and ultimately to pass it through Congress.
What are the greatest threats as seen by Food and Water Watch to the aquifers, to the drinking supplies that most people in this country depend upon? Is it the seepage of PCBs or petroleum byproducts from urban centers, or is it fracking, or is it some other atmospheric-related phenomenon? What are the greatest dangers to preserving underground water or lakes as well?
The bad thing is there's no lack of options to choose from, right? But I think for us, it really is fracking. I mean, I think that that's really the most dire threat to our water supply, and certainly why Food and Water Watch has worked, you know, extensively in New York, but really across the country in this fight to ban fracking. So we would certainly say that's the biggest threat.
The other thing that we're very much interested in following up on is that there was recently a major national gathering of institutions like your own on a lobbying and protest mission to Washington, D.C., with the goal of educating legislators and perhaps pushing back against the industry influence in Washington, but also bringing together local organizations that might be fighting independently but in parallel. Are you aware of a new nationalizing of the anti-fracking movement, and what progress have you seen so far?
Yeah, I mean, I am, and that event you're talking about in D.C. was a great one. So there was, I think, over 5,000 folks, an important one with over 5,000 activists. And I think that thing you highlighted is really essential, that it was groups from all over the country coming together. You know, and one highlight, I think, from my perspective anyway, from New York, is, you know, there's just a huge rally in Washington, D.C., and at the rally, there were tons and tons of people, not New Yorkers, but just, you know, ordinary citizens from across the country. And many, many of them had signs directed at Governor Cuomo and asking him to ban fracking, which I thought was really fantastic. And I think it does show a really important thing, that all eyes are kind of on us here in New York. I've done this work across the country, and I can tell you that in Ohio and Pennsylvania and a lot of these other states, when you talk to folks who are, you know, they're involved in their own local struggles to ban fracking in their own communities, everyone really gets that we have to do this in New York, and that if we don't win here, it's going to be really difficult for, you know, people across the country. So I thought that was really interesting. I mean, there's lots of folks. There's a great photo of Josh Fox, who is the director of Gasland, holding up a sign, and right next to him is a man from Pavilion, Wyoming, which is one of these communities that has had water contamination. And it was just sort of cool to see this coming together of worlds, I guess, where people realize what a big issue this is, you know.
Well, the other problem or the issue here is the legislative and litigative counter-reaction of the fracking and petroleum industry. And not only in New York, but I believe in Pennsylvania, Delaware region, and perhaps out west as well, in other parts of the country, there are efforts to strip localities of jurisdiction and regulation of fracking practices in their own backyard. How big a battle is that?
Oh, it's huge. I mean, you know, here in New York, so far there's been a moratorium, so it's been a little bit under the radar, but it's an enormous issue, you know, just in the same part of the shale, just south of us in Pennsylvania, and then a little bit west in Ohio. This has been an enormous battle, and where they have local control, and by that I mean where, you know, a municipality, a town, a city has the ability to say, no, we don't want fracking in our community. you know, obviously that has a huge impact, and a lot of communities do not want it and so have the ability to stop it. So I think it's a huge issue, but, you know, it's not the whole battle. I mean, it really is broader than that. A lot of this is going to occur out in rural areas and not in city limits. And so I think we have to be cognizant of that and support local control, but also realize that it's not the whole thing, that there's a broader fight here. And if fracking is unsafe in one place, it's not like when you move to another town, it's more safe. I mean, it's kind of the problem in New York, right, where they've said, okay, we won't do it here in the watershed, but we'll do it in the Southern Tier, or that's at least the proposed, the leaked proposal. And it's just kind of ludicrous on its face. I mean, if something's not safe in New York City, it's not safe in Broome County either.
Mm. Our guest is Alex Beauchamp of Food and Water Watch. And Alex, for those who are concerned about the environment and its future and their consumption of the products of it, tell people what you do at Food and Water Watch and how one may learn more about this and these subjects.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the obvious thing is you can go to our website. It's very simple, just foodandwaterwatch.org. And really, we think that policy really matters, right? And that we should get back to a system in which what we think influences policy. So I think we're always encouraging people to get engaged with their own governments, with their own elected officials, and tell them, if you don't want fracking in your community, you have to tell them that. And then after you're done, you have to tell them that again. It's sort of a long, long process. And so I think that's the really the key thing. But you can certainly go there. And then we're also part of a coalition effort that folks should go to. So this is called New Yorkers Against Fracking. This is over 150 groups that have come out against fracking across the state. And that website is nyagainstfracking.org. So folks should go to that as well.
Well, Alex Beauchamp of Food and Water Watch, I thank you for your factual insight and your clarity today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York.
All day I face the barren waste without the taste of water. Old Dan and Guy with throats burned dry and souls that cry for water. Cool, clear water. The nights are cool and I'm a fool. Each star's a pool of water. And with the dawn I'll wake and yawn and carry on to water. Cool, clear water. Keep a moving, Dan, don't you listen to him, Dan. He's the devil, not a man. And he spreads the burning sand with water. Dan, can you see that big green tree where the water's running free and it's waiting there for you and me? Water, cool, clear water. The shadows sway and seem to say, tonight we pray for water. Cool water. And way up there he'll hear our prayer and show us where there's water. Cool, clear water. Keep a moving, and don't you listen to him, Dan. He's the devil, not a man. And he spreads the burning sand with water. Dan, can you see that big green tree where the water's running free and it's waiting there for you and me? Water. Cool, clear water.
And that concludes today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow. The program was produced by Thiago Barroso and engineered by Michael G. Haskins. We welcome your comments, tips, queries, leaks, suggestions, and questions with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. That's theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.